This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we start today at the State House. Governor Maura Healey joins us from our WBUR office there to answer our questions and yours. Governor, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good morning. Great to be with you, Tiziana.
So our first chance to talk to you since you're all official in office, but I got to start with the fun stuff, which is the Celtics, of course. All-Star weekend this weekend, Jason Tatum has been named as a starter. Really, really hard question for you here. Your take on the first half of the season, and when they come back from the great break, do they have it in the tank to go all the way?
Well, absolutely. And first off, let me just say it's great to be with you. This is the first time I've been on since I've started work as yep. governor, and it's great to be able to be with you all this morning. I am pumped about a lot of things, including the future here in Massachusetts, but also about the Celtics. They've been a great team to watch all year long. I think there are a number of folks who had questions given sort of how things started earlier in the year with the coaching change, and they have just been such an exciting team. They're truly teammates. They play so well together. They play really hard. I absolutely know they can go all the way. Even last night when they lost to the Bucks in overtime, I mean, that was a loss where they didn't even have their starters in. And, you know, they've had some injuries. Jalen will be back. I just think they're a super exciting team, and it's always fun in this town to be able to root for our teams.
Do you get to go to as many games as you'd like to?
No, but I try to watch. I try to watch sometimes from home, and I certainly am following them closely. I did get to go to one game this year. Actually, I've been to two games this year. I went once when the Royals were in town, and then I went to the Lakers game a couple of Saturday nights ago with it's always fun to see LeBron. It's really fun to see LeBron get beaten. And so that was a great time in the garden.
All right. So you ready to do some news?
Yeah, sure. Of course.
Okay. Let's start with a bunch of just like sort of lightning round policy questions on news of the day. Quick question, quick answer, move on to the next one. And I do want to note we're going to pepper the whole conversation with questions from our listeners. They send them in through our texting group, and you can join that texting group, listeners, by texting the word Boston to 617-766-0382. So right out of the gate, Stephen of Arlington asked, Massachusetts, it's expensive. We have had record revenue and now the millionaire's tax. What are her tax cut plans to give people a break? So when can we expect a tax relief plan from you?
Well, I really appreciate Steve's question. And, you know, this is something that I focused on throughout the campaign. I have made it a priority, making the state more affordable to folks. Massachusetts is a great place, as long as you can afford to live here. And right now, with the cost of housing, the cost of childcare, and then some of what we've seen in terms of inflationary pressures, it's tough. And so you will see that I will be filing at the same time as my budget on March 1st, a tax package. It's a tax package directed at making life more affordable for folks. And we are busy putting the final touches on that proposal right now. But I completely appreciate, you know, Steve's comment that, you know, there are so many good things that we have going for us here. And I hope we get to talk about that, because the opportunity for economic development, the opportunity to take advantage of some of the federal funding, particularly around our tech sector and climate and infrastructure, there's a lot we can do. But we also have to deal with the immediate need that too many families right now are struggling with a high cost of living.
I want to pick up on the tech sector in just a second, but just a fast follow-up on that. You have prioritized things like seniors. There's been conversation about moving the floor of the estate tax. Anything you can tell us about key themes we will see in that release on March 1st?
Well, you know, I think it really does involve a package. And, you know, we've talked about progressive tax relief. So, you know, thinking about how we can target those most vulnerable, our seniors, renters. Also, you know, what are the things we can offer for families when you talk about child tax credits and the like? The goal here is to make Massachusetts more affordable. It's necessary for our families. And also, Tiziana, it's really important for our competitiveness, right? So whether you're talking about child tax credit proposals that I've talked about before or other forms of relief, this goes to us showing and making clear to people, look, Massachusetts is a place where you can come here, you can come here to learn and study, you can come here to grow a business, you can come here to work and afford to stay here. And if you're from here, born here, this is the place where we want you to stay, we want you to grow families, and we want you to grow careers, right? So that's what this is about.
So let's pick up on competitiveness. You visited The Engine yesterday. It's a venture firm in Cambridge. We actually had Katie Ray for a Phenomenal Women at City Space and here on Radio Boston last year. You announced that Massachusetts is going to lead this new alliance called the Northeast Regional Microelectronics Coalition. And to kind of break this down for listeners, there's an act out there, CHIPS and Science Act, focused on technology competitiveness, especially around semiconductors, future research, et cetera. And you want us to be as competitive as possible in getting that money. So what do we have to do best and most in order to make sure some of that money does come for tech competitiveness here in the Commonwealth?
Well, first off, I love Katie Ray, love The Engine. She's a powerhouse, and so is The Engine, which was created a few years ago to really support our tech and innovative startups, getting things from the lab to actual fabrication and taking advantage of harnessing the incredible strengths we have in our state. So you ask, what do we need to do? Well, we need to build on our strengths. We need to build on the strengths that we have with our research institutions, our academic institutions, with venture capital, with private equity, with what we have here in this incredible collection, this ecosystem in Massachusetts. And then the work we have to do, and specifically in government, is to make sure we are putting together the best grant proposals to take advantage of funding that's available for chips, semiconductors, and also infrastructure and the like. And
so I'm going to jump in there and just follow up on what you said. So when I hear you say that, what immediately pops into my head, Governor, is that's a lot of cross-sector collaboration, right? You've got academics, which is tricky because on the one hand, you need some separation, right, on those things. And on others, you got to bring all, you know, no disrespect, but I've worked in most of the sectors, you got to kind of herd those cats. So how do you do that with a kind of speed that gets us competitive for that money?
Well, you know, first off, I will say this. I don't want us to just be competitive. I want us to win, right? I want us to win these federal funds. Massachusetts, we've led the nation for so long in technology and innovation, life sciences. We just have a history here. And I want us to continue to lead by winning. So it's not just about competing, it's actually winning. And to do that, Tiziana, we have to do things that we haven't done before. You know, I'm a point guard, and, you know, the job of a point guard is to help quarterback a team and get different players, different positions working together. We've got to have that kind of collaboration here in Massachusetts, bringing together industry, entrepreneurs, our academic and research institutions, workforce partners, community colleges, along with government agencies at the state and federal level, to put together packages to say, hey, this is our game plan. This is us working as a team, and here's what we're looking to do. If you give us the money, you're going to get, to the Biden administration, you are going to get an incredible return on investment. You are going to see growth in jobs, in workforce. You are going to see the spurring of new technologies, not just, you know, as ideas in labs, but actually out there manufactured. You know, think about what China is doing right now. We have the capability to disrupt China's attempt to dominate in certain spaces,
like
right here out of Massachusetts.
Space.
Exactly. I want Massachusetts to be the semiconductor capital of the world.
So
we have an opportunity to do that by working together. I'm pleased that our Mass Tech Collaborative, which is a state quasi entity, is quarterbacking this collaboration for this particular CHIPS grant. But we've got billions and billions of dollars out there that we want to play for.
Yeah, let's stay there with the federal money and where we need it, because you were also in Washington, D.C. You talked to Secretary of Transportation Pete Buttigieg. We're talking about the, you know, Bourne and Sagamore bridges and several other infrastructure and transportation things. Federal funding seems important there, but we had a stumble. We talked to Boston Mayor Michelle Wu about some stumbling on federal transportation money. Are we positioned to get the money that we need from the federal government to do those bridge replacements and some other key infrastructure stuff? And can we do it if we don't get that money?
Well, we have to get it done, and we absolutely have to make sure that the Cape Cod bridges get rebuilt. We have to make sure that there are investments in roads and bridges and other forms of transportation and infrastructure. I think it's a both and. On the state level, one of the first things I did when I took office was file a nearly $1 billion bond bill that included funding for economic development, in addition to a $400 million bill specifically for roads and bridges. So, you know, we as a state have to make those investments. We also have to work with our federal partners. The reason I went to Washington, D.C. last week and the reason I brought my team was to sit down and specifically meet with Secretary Buttigieg on transportation, Mitch Landrieu, who's in charge of all the infrastructure funding, and others in the administration to talk about, to make the case for investments in Massachusetts. Now, in order to get those, we're going to have to work very closely with our federal delegation. We have the best delegation in the entire country, by the way, who are hustling and working hard on behalf of all folks across the Commonwealth. We also have to tie in, though, and make the showing of how we're going to do this in a way that drives workforce development and that implements these projects right away. We've got to be shovel ready. So, that my team is focused on.
Let me ask that clarifying question there. Just to be really clear, so you're saying that two of the key success factors here is going to be showing how this infrastructure investment makes more jobs and that we can do it fast, that when the money hits, we have the ability in the Commonwealth to spend it fast and, you know, sort of get going right away. Am I understanding you correctly?
Yes, and I'll add a third thing. One is they want to show that the state has skin in the game and is willing also to put up investment dollars. And that's, you know, what you saw in my bond bill, and it's what you'll see in the budget. We've got to show that we're not just relying on federal funding exclusively, that we're working to apply our own funding and investments. And on the jobs point, you know, one thing I really want to drive home that we're focused on, it's making sure that we show how we are creating jobs across this state, right down to the community and neighborhood level, how we are working with community colleges, our vocational schools, tying that together with our manufacturing operations and other companies, private sector companies out there. That kind of showing of cohesion, that we've got a pipeline that we're going to be able to deliver, is also going to be really important in securing these funds.
So there are two threads.
A lot of coordination.
Yeah, two threads there I want to pick up on. We'll come back to the state having the skin in the game, because that takes us a couple of places. But first, this jobs thing, I know you know that this was the last year of the increases that have been planned since 2018 in the minimum wage, getting us up to $15 an hour. I know you also know that all of the research on what a living wage in Massachusetts says is that it's not $15 an hour. It's north of 20, depending on family size. So we just get this done. It's already not enough. Do you think we need to take a next step towards increasing the minimum wage?
You know, I think right now I am very much focused on what we have in terms of revenue, what we have in anticipated revenue, and what I can do in support through my proposed budget. As we talked about earlier, there's a piece of this that's really going to be focused on when we file our tax proposal, driving the affordability point. So, you know, I think we can get there. Do we need to make sure that people are able to, you know, buy food, secure housing, have access to childcare? All of this we need to do. So, you know, when you talk about affordability, certainly wage and minimum wage is important, but it's also important to look at what are we doing around food security? What are we doing around housing? What are we doing to drive down the cost of childcare? As you know, probably later next month, which would be March, I'll be filing legislation to create a Secretary of Housing, so that we have a secretariat exclusively focused on creating more housing around the state so that rents and the cost of homes will be more affordable. So we've got to look at all of this.
So a couple of other things. Let's talk about housing. One, Middleborough. There's new news out today about Middleborough wanting to push back on these MBTA sort of housing zones, right? I'm just kind of keeping the basics on it. We need states, we need cities and towns to increase that capacity. They've got a new commuter rail coming in. They did not file their draft plan. What are you going to do about cities and towns that I know I sound editorial, but I got to make this question sharp for you, right? That don't want to play ball on the new state law around zoning around MBTA transportation to help with jobs, housing affordability, transportation, et cetera.
I'm sorry. We had a little band activity here in the State House.
I heard that. It was kind of freaking me out. I'm like, why do I?
Well, I love it. You know, it's been quiet, so it's nice to
Do you need me to repeat
nice
the
to
question?
See young people in the building.
Do you need me to repeat your question?
Okay. No, I've got it. Super important question. The good news on that is that we've actually seen a 97% compliance rate by communities in coming forward with plans that that meet what was required under the policy. We also have some more work to do. And I think what we need to do is have conversations directly with communities, work with them on how to get there. The Lieutenant Governor and I, Lieutenant Governor Kim Driscoll, fantastic, by the way. People will come to know her and love her if they don't already. She is hyper-focused on the housing agenda. And we know this is going to require real and sometimes hard conversations with communities. We're just not going to get there. And when I talk about Massachusetts competitiveness, I do not want to see families or businesses leaving for North Carolina, South Carolina, Texas, because they cannot afford the cost of housing.
So does that mean that opting out is just not going to be an option for cities and towns?
Opting out is not an option. But what we need to do is work with these communities and figure out a way to get there. And you know, we're a commonwealth. We've got to do this across the state. And every community is different. Every community is unique. But this administration, this team is really going to lean in here and figure out our way through this. We have to. Because if we don't drive down housing costs by creating more housing, we are going to lose as a state. We're going to see more people leave and go other places. And that's just not where we need to go. So, you know, we will work carrots and stick. We will work on compliance. We will work and collaborate with communities. But we've got to really get everybody to understand the value proposition in doing this and the risk if we don't.
Okay, so as you have noted before, housing and transit then also go hand in hand. We were just talking about that intersection. So let's stay with transit, where the state does have a lot of skin in the game. Reporting from the Boston Herald this morning that underscores concerns about the quality of the work from this contractor, CRRC, that's providing the Orange and Red Line trains. They're saying, minutes from meetings that show, for example, the company trying to push past on inspections or reusing, quote, safety-critical hardware, end quote. So a spokesperson from your office told them that you've got this independent team of experts that you called for to hammer out safety issues with CRRC in place. So have they now begun that work? And what is the top priority you need them to focus on to get literally orange and red lanes back on red line trains back on track?
Yeah, super important. As I've said before, we don't have a functioning economy without a functioning public transit system. It is just a top priority, and that goes across all modes, not just the T, our commuter rail, buses, regional transit authorities, and the like. So 2 weeks into our job, we learned for the first time that this facility out in Springfield was way behind in terms of its delivery of cars, red and orange line cars. And so what I did immediately was to assemble a team, and they have already started work. In fact, our Secretary of Transportation was out there on the ground on Monday, and we are going to be all over this. Basically, right now, there are operational issues that need to be addressed, and problems are being corrected as they occur. The team will have a constant presence at the facility right now.
So
that's going to be an ongoing process.
There.
Physically, you have to be physically there. Remember, this is a company that years ago, the state struck a deal with a Chinese company to fabricate, because a lot of these cars are, most of the cars are sort of made in China, and then they're shipped over for final fabrication. Well, it turns out that, there were certain things missed in the process, and it looks like the facility itself didn't actually have the capability to fabricate as quickly or in the way it needed to. So, when I learned about this, the job was to get right on it, put a team together of technical experts, engineers, to figure out how to retool things at the facility and how to operationalize that so we can expedite the production and the delivery of these cars as quickly as possible.
So before I let you go, I know you're on a clock here, so I'm going to try to get a couple more things in that I just really want to hear from you on. The first is Massachusetts State Police. So Colonel Christopher Mason is retiring. He'll step down, I think, next week. Many know that according to the 2020 police reform law, you now can look to someone outside the Massachusetts State Police to take that job. You've said, you know, you'll look outside, you'll look inside. Given the sort of scandal-laden history of the state police, especially over the last decade or so, is looking outside for reform a top priority?
Well, let me just give an update on that. Colonel Mason will be stepping down on Friday, and I do want to thank him for his years of service. I will be naming an interim colonel, and we also will be undertaking a thorough search process. My job, my responsibility, is to get the best colonel in place, and that person may well come from outside of the state police. They may come from within the state police. You're right. The legislation now allows me as governor to make an appointment that is not limited to someone from within the ranks. And, you know, I am very mindful of the history of the state police, some of the context of all of this. I'm just focused on getting the right person for that job.
What does that mean for you? So, I mean, you've just given us some stuff, but when we think about hiring, right, we tend to have an idea in mind. So two key characteristics of somebody who can come in and get that job done in your mind.
Integrity and managerial competence. You know, it's a big organization, and it's really important that always there's integrity. The public trust is so imperative. And then managerial competence, running a great department.
Okay, so let's ask just one listener question. There's 800 more things I'd like to talk to you about, but Jenny from Princeton writes, regarding PFAS contamination of drinking water, will you please consider establishing a rebate program for private well owners to be reimbursed for installing point of entry treatment systems? New Hampshire has a program that provides rebates to private well users for up to $5,000 for the installation and up to $10,000 for a service connection to a public water system. I'm going to step back from that and say, as we increasingly become aware of the burdens of previous decisions that affect our climate and health and need to move forward to mitigate, do we and can you allocate funds that are going to give us a chance to offset those costs for people?
We have to, you know, and Jenny, thank you for the question. As you know, I come to this as having been the Attorney General, where we did an awful lot to take on environmental injustices, pollution, address climate. I already, as governor, have done a couple things that no governor has ever done before, name a cabinet-level position of climate chief, who's making sure that across all secretariats, housing, economic development, healthcare, the like, we are driving a climate agenda. We also just appointed a person who is new position, an undersecretary for environmental justice. So, you know, when it comes to PFAS, know that I want to do everything we can as a state to help homeowners out, of course, municipalities out. PFAS is a big problem. The numbers around PFAS in terms of its cost are just astronomical. We're definitely going to need help from the federal government. I will have my team look at what New Hampshire is doing to see if there's something that we could do there that's comparable. But, you know, I just want to express my concern for all things related to pollution and the need to do what we can here in our state to address pollution, to reduce the health risk, and to also, you know, take advantage of this time. And people may not know this, but through the various laws that the Biden administration has passed, bipartisan, by the way, the last couple of years, there's close to $1 trillion out there that will go towards climate. And this comes back to Massachusetts competitiveness. This is a place I want us playing for those dollars. I want those dollars to make our communities safer, healthier, to address the issues that we have around everything from, you know, pollution in our rivers, the PFAS pollution, as well as, you know, what we're encountering right now in some municipalities running out of space for solid waste, right? While also incentivizing and driving the climate technology and innovation that's just going to help power us away from fossil fuels. And that includes really, really exciting things that are happening here in Massachusetts. I visited with some of those companies just yesterday, including a company, Form, that is about making batteries whose storage will help us considerably. We also need to make the investment in building out transmission and the grid and the like so that we can take advantage of offshore wind. And a lot there, okay? So there's a lot of challenge, Tiziana, but there's a lot of opportunity for us if we work together as a state.
And there's so much more I'd love to dive into. I know I'm going to get in trouble with your team if I don't let you go, but all the more reason, let's have you back on again as soon as possible, Governor Healey, so we can talk about this more.
It's budget season, so we're going to go back and crunch some more numbers, but I look forward to coming on again soon.
Great. Governor Maura Healey, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Maria Barrio's artwork. The works are huge, they're intricate, and they're absolutely drenched in color. And when you look at one from, let's say, 10 or 20 feet back, it looks like a watercolor. The pigment flows in a way that feels liquid and effortless. And then you get up close and you see that it's actually an incredibly precise paper collage. And I will say, you then think, how is this possible? Well, Maria's got a new exhibit that will give you a chance to ask that question. It opens tomorrow at Boston's Institute of Contemporary Art, the ICA, and it's called The Children's Crusade. It's a collection of collages that go to a place where innocence meets complexity and the massive burdens sometimes of childhood. They pull from history, from poetry, folklore, to explore the stories of kids and the immigrant experience. Maria is here in Studio 2. Welcome.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to be here with you.
It's wonderful to have you here. And I just want to start with the exhibit. It's about migration. It's about kids. Why? I mean, you can create art about anything, anytime you want. Why this and why now?
My work deals a lot with migration. And I started to research about the Children's Crusade in the year 1212. And it was a crusade where we don't really have much information about it, but it said that children traveled from Northern Europe to conquer the Holy Land. But
no, so let's just, because this is so inconceivable to people today, we are talking about a group of children alone walking across Europe in literally a religious crusade.
Yeah.
And most wound up either dying or being permanently living on their own in Italy or being enslaved, etc.
Exactly. And there's really little information about these. But I started to research in that theme, and then I started to find the connection with what is going on in the Mediterranean and in the U.S. border. So I started to think about this idea of how would children feel or see these migratory journeys. And in my work, I usually take things from reality, from current political or social or environmental issues, and I see them through the lens of magical realism. So I see them through fantasy. So I wanted to create these pieces in which you feel like you're seeing through the eyes of children.
So I'm going to then jump right to a piece that is in this exhibit. It's called Cavalry.
Yeah.
And I think I have a picture of it right here. Mm-hmm. And what was striking to me about Cavalry, it is an explosion of color, and it's young children on a carousel. And they don't look like they're playing. They look like they're confused. And they look like they're stuck going in circles. And again, I'm going to underscore, you do this with collage, but it looks like a cacophony of color and painting. What's the story in this painting? And what do you want people who witness your art, right, who take it in, to understand?
Yeah, this piece talks about this idea of going around in circles and not getting anywhere. And this, like my work, it has a lot of symbolism, and I wanted to project this journey that children take without like a you know, like going to the promised land and not knowing exactly what is promised to them.
Because a carousel is supposed to be fun. It's supposed to be an amusement ride, but that's not what you're doing here.
No, here is like the kind of seeing the bleakness of it, the bleakness of this journey. And in this particular piece, like you can also, you find these mirrors and these animals that also symbolize different figures in the journey.
I think this is a goat here in the front. I can't see all the other animals in the, because I'm just, you know, I'm not in front of the whole piece right now. When you began to put this art together, you're looking at what's happening in the Mediterranean, you're looking at what's happening on the southern border, and later in this hour, we're actually going to have a conversation about unaccompanied minors here in the Commonwealth and how we're supporting them. You have a migrant story of your own. You came from Colombia. When your parents went back, you stayed at quite a young age and studied art. Did you find yourself in this work?
I did. I think my circumstance is nothing like the circumstances of these migrants. Like, I came to the U.S. in a very different way. And so I can't, like, really talk from them in a way. But through art, I'm just kind of creating maybe some awareness to their situation. But I do feel like I like, coming here, you are kind of looking for a sense of place, but it's you make your own place. So it is a very different circumstance in a sense.
So I am not an artist. Mm-hmm. It's almost impossible for me to even imagine where the artistic process starts for you. And then I see these massive pieces, right? And I know that's a choice. Mm-hmm. And I see that you're working with paper. This is not the magazine collage, folks, of your kindergarten classroom, right? This is Japanese collage paper, as I understand it. Did you see these children on the carousel and the mirrors and the animals and the colors and the story it was going to tell from the beginning, and you reconstruct it with collage? Or are you working as you go and discovering?
Yeah, this particular piece came from a photograph, actually, from the Boston Commons. So it kind of like relates to Boston. But I do, like, there is a very mysterious, like, every piece, like, is its process is very mysterious. You can encounter different characters as you are making the work. So every piece has a different process. In this particular, I did, this image came from reality, but if you see the show, other pieces are completely created from, like, little pieces of my imagination.
So first, it's the Frog Pond Carousel, which I think for people locally, when they see the show, to know that you are using an image of the Frog Pond Carousel to communicate something that is actually hopeless or overwhelming and lost for children, I think that sits. You actually also, in another piece, you use essentially your own son lying on sand, and he's sort of tracing a shape of him, of his arms, like Snow Angel, almost on sand. And I wondered about that, too, as a mother of two kids. And you're telling a story of lost children or vulnerable children or children who are making a journey that most of us would be too afraid to make in adulthood. Situating your own son in that, what was that like for you?
I think it's in a way, like, these situations hit harder if you're a mother, in a sense, because you can relate to the pain of, like, a mother being separated from their children. So in a sense, just situating him gives me a closer look to what it could feel like. So as I said before, there's nothing, you know, I could never experience that pain, and I could never, like, talk for the people who are going through this. But I think as an artist, like, painting is a very emotional thing. So when you are putting your son in these images, of course you are closer to it. You feel the love that you feel for your children, and you can't imagine what it would be your life with them, without them.
Do you have favorites? Like, in an exhibit, will there be a painting, or not a painting, excuse me, a collage that is your favorite?
I think they are like my children. So it would be really hard to choose, but I always love the one I finished I just finished.
You love the last one
you
made.
The last one you made. Yeah. So I think it's always that one.
And are you making new art now?
Yeah.
So what's come next? What comes next for you?
Well, I'm working. I'm taking a little break, a deserved break, and then I'll start a new body of work. So I'll have a couple of exhibitions coming up. So I'm really excited to continue and to present this work at the ICA.
So Maria Barrio is a visual artist, and her new exhibition is The Children's Crusade. It opens tomorrow at the ICA, that's the Institute of Contemporary Art in Boston, and it focuses on the immigrant experience of kids. Maria, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we are staying with the theme of the child immigrant experience. Kids are vulnerable, and perhaps maybe never more so than when they migrate unaccompanied. Ideas we discussed with artist Maria Barrio in her exhibit, The Children's Crusade, just before we took a quick break. So let's turn our eyes now here to the Commonwealth. We welcome unaccompanied minors here, and we wanted to know how many, and how are our communities keeping kids safe? So Zan Weber is the Chief Advancement Officer at the International Institute of New England, which works in refugee resettlement, including with unaccompanied kids. Zan, welcome.
Thank you so much. It's so great to be with you today.
So I know you heard our conversation with Maria Barrio, and I'm struck again by this idea that she took a picture of safe, secure, joyful childhood play in the Boston Common on the Frog, Frog Pond Carousel, and turned it into a metaphor for a sense of being lost and stuck in a kind of rotation of, I don't know the word, maybe you do, but I'd love your reaction to that as someone who is working, and as I understand it, the International Institute is largely working with kids coming across from the southern border. So let's react to that work.
Yes, thank you. That's right. I spoke with Maria a little bit before her presentation, and then with her presentation, I'm just so awed and excited to be able to be a part of talking through children's experience through the lens of Maria's experience. And it is so challenging to be able to understand, contemplate, truly understand children's experience as they're crossing the border into the U.S. And we've been in this work, the International Institute, for over 10 years, and it's still unfathomable in many ways. So to be able to hear about an experience and experience it not through words, but through images and a different creative way to express it, I think is truly inspiring, and I'm really looking forward to the show.
So, Zan, let's make this real for listeners whose lived experience may be very, very far from what we're talking about. In working with kids, especially those who have come unaccompanied across the southern border, in learning about their experiences, tell me a moment, an experience a kid had, something you were told where you were like, God, I didn't know, right? I didn't know this is what a kid is going through.
Wow, that is hard to pick just one. Again, we've been working in this work. I'm a social worker working in the work for 10 years now. And we serve about 300 kids a year. And this year, our program has expanded. So we're probably going to see over 900 to 1,000 children. And I can talk about that.
That's more than three times.
It is. And there's many different reasons for the expansion of the program, which I can talk about. But it's hard to pinpoint one story that is either more impressionable or more challenging to hear or to understand.
And I don't need you to pick a winner. I just need you to pick one that will, you know, for our listeners, help them understand.
Yeah. So one that just comes to mind is that, you know, there several children are fleeing. Mostly this is, you know, we work with children from the Northern Triangle, Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador. And there's many complex reasons for their forced migration to the U.S. But, you know, when I've heard, and I work with our social workers, a couple of stories about how challenging it is for girl migrants in these experiences, and how vulnerable they are to sexual violence in their communities, which is a part of the reason some of them are leaving, and then across the journey, and how challenging it is to avoid gang recruitment and the immediacy of, like, having somebody threaten you and you really physically, like, literally having to think about leaving the next day because maybe you're going to end up raped and then in a plastic bag. Mm. And that is truly what I've, you know, heard that some of the children in our program have been threatened by.
So I'll flag for listeners, when we talk about vulnerable children, we are going to talk about troubling content, and we're not going to shy away from that for the rest of this segment. So listeners, beware. It's interesting that you say that. Part of what made us want to ask this question, are we taking unaccompanied minors in the Commonwealth? How do we do that? Do we keep them safe? Comes from some reporting that came out of the UK beginning late last year. I'm going to play a little sound. A BBC investigation found that the British government was housing unaccompanied minors in hotels, basically on their own, and a number of kids were disappearing from the hotels, and the size of that was pretty shocking. Here's some sound for you.
116 children are missing and not been found. So the consequences of that are huge. I mean, if we don't know where they are, they could be dead. They could be working away in a cannabis farm, in a factory, domestic servitude. They could be being criminally exploited or sexually exploited behind closed doors, and nobody knows what's happening to them.
So the kids coming here, are they safe and how are we keeping them safe?
Yes, that's such a great question. And I'm really, again, just so glad we're taking a look at this. The U.S. government has a very longstanding commitment and obligation to children who cross the border unaccompanied. As soon as they cross, they're in the care of Homeland Security and the custody and care of the U.S. government and the Office of Refugee Resettlement. From that crossing and that initial detention, they move into a shelter program, and that can be anywhere in the country. From the shelter program, the U.S. government works very hard to find the families children are coming to connect to. So most children crossing unaccompanied are coming to join.
Are coming to someone?
Yes, they're coming. This is the pull factor. And they're often their, you know, family members, often their parents, if not a family member, then a close friend. In the shelter program, they're given a little bit of support, some mental health treatment, physical health treatment, and then this connection in search in the communities to try to find their a sponsor or their family. When they come into our area, and we work across New England and now in New York, we help reunify a child with their sponsor or their family. So we're meeting the child as soon as they travel to the Commonwealth, and then engaging them in services that are both designed to support their early integration, to get them connected to legal services, because unfortunately, as soon as they enter, they're in, you know, what is a deportation process. Basically, they've got to fight for their legal status. We tried to connect in the mental health services. That is very challenging. And we're basically just there to be an advocate for every child as they're reunifying.
So that the piece of that really helpful for, you know, the idea of sort of safety and care is this, that there's this suite of services. And I've read in some places sort of similar to how we would do foster care for kids. So bear with me.
Sure.
Who is caring for the child?
Yes.
Who knows that the kid had a bad day? Who knows if they have a cough or a fever? Who is caring for the child?
So I'm happy to say in most instances, we are reunifying children with their parents, and their parents are wonderfully grateful to see their children again and are so excited to be able to provide them care.
So for the 300 that came, that IINE helped with last year, the majority of them had parents here in the Is that because that's how it usually works, or is that because that's the kind of cases that International Institute is taking?
No, that is typical of what pulls children unaccompanied to the U.S.
Okay.
They have family that have come before. They have been threatened by poverty, crushing hunger, violence in their own country, and they're they're coming to join their family. They're not coming here to go into our foster care system to you know, wander the streets. They're here really to help reconnect with their family. Their families may have, you know, supported their journey here because they're so desperate. They want to get as many people here into safety as possible.
So you connect them with the family.
Yes.
You connect them with services.
Yeah.
That's the vast majority.
Yes.
What about the kids where that's not the case?
So fortunately, our program historically for the last 10 years had only been available to about 20% of children crossing the border and apprehended and in federal custody. The other 80% were what we call straight released into their communities without any formal support.
I don't know what you mean by into their communities. Do you mean into the city or town they came into across the border, or do you?
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. Reunify with their families in communities across the country.
Okay.
So the majority of children had no formal support. Just last year, the Biden administration opened up a program like ours, and we're one of many different types of programs across the U.S. that works with family reunification to every child. So now 100% of children in federal shelter and custody, when they reunify, are offered support services.
These supports and services.
Yes.
And I should note, we are talking to Zan Weber, who's the Chief Advancement Officer at the International Institute of New England. So is there anything that we do, and the answer might be no.
Yep.
Is there anything that we do in the Commonwealth that is unique or distinctive? So, for example, we know that in family housing, right, we are unique in the Commonwealth in that if a family is homeless and has a child under the age of 18 or there is a pregnant person,
yep,
then we have an obligation to house. Is there anything with kids that's different here?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, when we first started the program, there were about, I think, well, in 2015, 28,000 kids crossing. Last year was 128,000. 2,700 came to Massachusetts. So we have children, we have thousands and thousands of children across the Commonwealth who are integrating into our communities. Fortunately, we have, a broader safety net than some other states. Undocumented communities, families, children are not offered the same amount of support than people with legal status, which is really, really, really unfortunate. But we do have limited mental health services, limited mass health, comprehensive physical health services. Our public schools are some of the greatest partners in our work and have years and years of experience working with unaccompanied children, have some support programs available to them, some therapists. By and large, there is not enough formal clinical therapy and therapeutic work for children in this population, but we do have partners, and the Commonwealth as a whole has been able to sort of offer more support than other states.
All right. Zan Weber is the Chief Advancement Officer at the International Institute of New England, talking with us about how we welcome and care for unaccompanied minors who come into the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Thanks for being on the show today.
Thank you so much.
And that is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow. We've got a barn burner of a show for you on Radio Boston.